Hello and welcome to the super pumped edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I am here with Emily Peck of the Huffington Post.
Hello.
I am here with our other co-host, Anna Szymanski, who amazingly has an affiliation.
I have now.
I'm no longer
working at the mysterious company. I have shifted now officially to financial journalism.
Why would anyone voluntarily become a journalist?
It's a very good question. Yeah, most people don't finish their CFA and then be like, I'm going to go into journalism.
but welcome to the tribe.
So I'm going to be working with Reuters Breaking Views.
All right.
Your
alma mater.
So now we have four journalists around the table because we also have Mr. Mike Isaac of the New York Times.
Hello, hello.
Welcome. You are here because you are on book tour. You've written an amazing new book called...
This is called Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber.
It's great. It's
such
in
a good
all
book.
Good bookstores. It's a fun read. And so, yeah, we're going to talk to Mike about his book and about Uber and about Travis Kalanick and then about the new Travis Kalanick, who's Adam Neumann of WeWork, and about what on earth is going on with all of the WeWork crazy. We are going to be talking about the power that workers are beginning to show over companies like GM and maybe even Uber, thanks to Californian legislation. It's a fun conversation. You should stick around for it. We're even going to talk about repo in Slate Plus because,
yes,
you know, we have to. All that coming up in Slate Money.
On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Debt, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
So, Mike, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
How's it doing?
I think it's doing all right. We hit the bestseller list, which was nice. The New York Times bestseller list, and like people seem to actually be reading it. They're like tweeting shots at the airport at me. So I guess that's a measure of success.
So what's the subject that they mostly glom onto? Is it basically, oh my God, Travis was amazingly evil?
The weird thing is, everyone seems to like my penchant for footnotes.
Your footnotes are fantastic.
That is literally
yes.
what everyone is tweeting more than like. Crazy well,
the
Google
is,
affair.
The footnotes is always about you, right?
Right.
It's when it's actually when Mike winds up going, oh shit, I'm going to have to insert myself into the book here.
That's basically it. I think that's where I can't tweet in book form, so I had to get it out in the footnotes.
For me, it felt like being transported back into another era, but the era was just a few years ago.
Yeah, right.
Just all the stuff about Travis and the culture was just... It was almost like more shocking to read about now than it was to live through it because you had put it all in one place. And you open the book, right, with that big party.
Yeah.
You've got to open with a party. That was the other great book that we had on, what was
the
it last
billion
year?
The Billion Dollar Whale. Also opens with a party. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the Billion Dollar Whale party can possibly outdo even Travis, although it was close. They didn't have Beyonce.
Right. Beyonce was the icing on the cake for Travis's party and that it cost $25 million.
But, and she got like $6 million of equity.
Right.
And then after IPO, that was worth like less than $6 million.
Right.
It's like, ouch, it's like, she got in early in the private round, but like that doesn't really help you when the stock falls off a cliff.
Oh God!
But then the culture was his selling point, and then it was ultimately his downfall, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. No,
I don't know.
I do think that. I think that people don't really realize how bad it was until you go look how condensed the like number of gnarly things that came out happened. You know, like in very short order. Like it was just sort of the election, and then his Trump counsel problem, and then Fowler memo, and then Google getting sued, and all this stuff, like really quickly. And I think that like 10 years, or probably like 7 or 8 years of crap all came to bear in early 2017 and ended up being the thing that just...
I was curious because it definitely reading it in the condensed form, it just seemed like, wow, this is kind of unprecedented. But it made me think, because last year we had this oral history of Silicon Valley that we read and talked about. And
cool.
And as I was reading your book, there were things in it that I was like, this actually reminds me of stuff that happened at other companies. But I think part of the difference was that you know, no one was covering it. There wasn't as much media. And also, like, people didn't care about the misogyny in a way that they do now.
My thesis on this, so I totally agree. I think my thesis on this is like, and I say this in the book, like, I really do think the election of Trump gave people more, and like some of the thing, the threads around it, even if there isn't a direct through line from, like, say, Cambridge Analytica or Russian interference to we elected Donald Trump or we got Brexit, I still think it made people think about tech in a different way than they had before. And like, oh, people might be able to manipulate my thoughts or whatever based on the news feed. And so I do think that scrutiny of tech just increased after that. And then, and my guess is if Uber wasn't such a shit show, it would have been Facebook to get its reckoning right after, you know, but then Uber imploded and Facebook got it deferred to 2018.
It was
almost unfair because you go through
the delete
Uber like movement and hashtag, the way you lay it out. I was surprised to kind of realize that Uber
it's not clear what they did wrong in that particular
instance. They didn't really do anything that wrong for once, but that was like the catalyst for then basically their demise. Yeah. It really hurt them. But all they had done was turn off surge pricing.
It really was. It was
people really hated surge pricing, and then when they turned them off, that's even worse.
If they had kept it on, I feel like you could have had the same outcome. It actually wouldn't have mattered at all. Right. Because if they had it on,
they would have been profiting from
getting people.
There's literally no good way to navigate that. But that's the problem when you are in that situation where everyone is primed to hate you. Then it's a little bit like when you're being canceled on Twitter. Nothing you say is going to help.
That's right. That's
you can't reverse it.
And it started with a tweet. So,
and does that maybe also suggest that like Travis was almost that figure that, like, if he hadn't existed, we'd have had to invent him, almost in the sense of, especially like as you said, like in this kind of post-Trump period where people just had so much anger and wanted to do something, and he, you know, in so many ways, he was this Trumpish figure that people could attack.
So one thing that kept coming up as I was reporting this book from people who worked with him or under him or continued to work with him is that they kept calling him Trumpian, weirdly, like, or just sort of how he created his own reality, but had this charisma that kept people around him, but also was surrounded by people who wouldn't really challenge him in direct ways. And it was just the way that he ran it was supposedly very Trumpian. And
So my question is Uber the poster child of the tech clash? Was Uber the big company to really suffer from the tech clash? Or was Uber idiosyncratic in that way and related to the Trump election and Travis personally? And you can't really extrapolate to anyone else.
I think this is probably unsatisfying, but I think it's a little bit of both. I think that like part of their getting caught up in this gnarliness was basically timing and the fact that Travis is the Uber bro and kind of was an avatar for a lot of the things that people hate about tech in the abstract, you know, but some things were very specific to them, you know, like you can talk about a culture of misogyny throughout the tech industry, but I think at Uber, it was just that times 100. It was like misogyny, like sprayed with Axe body spray or whatever. But I think that being like paramount has still opened the door for that criticism at every other company. And we're starting to see that in different ways and like see internally the workers actually being upset or pushing back more than they have in the past. So I think that's also like probably a good thing or fair game, at least. Like maybe they had too much of a grace period for too long. And so this might be a good moment to at least look at it, if not like fully condemn all of it, just sort of be like, all right, what are we okay with?
Which brings me to, is it called AB5, the law in California?
Yeah.
Which is this law basically saying that the people who drive for Uber need to be considered to be employees. We've talked about this kind of issue for literally for years on Slate Money. The first question I have for you about that is the reason that it managed to get passed in what is meant to be the most tech-friendly state in the union, is that Uber-specific as well? Was there a feeling that just because people really hated Uber and they wanted Uber drivers to be employees that they would pass this bill? Or is it, again, like a much broader tech clash?
The impetus for the bill, according to what I just read in the Times yesterday, was actually a dispute with a driver for a company. I can't remember if it was a delivery company or
Dynamex, right?
Oh, that started in Dynamics?
I think so.
Yeah, and he was misclassified and there was a lawsuit and then that was the inspiration for AB5. It wasn't actually
right, but I guess
Uber
the question
inspired,
is
although Uber will obviously be quite affected and right. might have to spend like a half billion.
But yeah,
I
guess,
right, exactly. I mean, I think, yeah, yes, definitely. Like, it wasn't an Uber bill, but the I think, Felix, I think you're probably right. I mean,
like
that
what got it over
exactly,
the line.
Exactly. Right, why were people willing about, to rule in that way? It does seem like you can't. Like, Uber is a ginormous elephant in the room.
Well, it's you can look at the, there are stories of drivers who like sleep in their cars or have to pee in bottles on the side of the road or whatever, just like really gnarly conditions for folks like that. The interesting thing for me is that I've talked to as many drivers who are upset at it passing than as well as the ones who are in support of it, right? Because like a lot of folks, and those are the people that Uber pushes out to say like, look, they want to be flexible and not be employees or whatever.
And I think that is, it is complicated. I mean, I think that's the issue. It's not actually super simple because the vast majority of Uber drivers don't actually drive that many hours. And I think the issue is people want the flexibility. They just want to be paid a little bit better and they want to have a little bit more consistency.
But, okay, I mean, I need to ask you about this bill because I don't entirely understand. I don't think anyone entirely understands what the consequences will be. But is it a rational, reasonable worry for people who are currently working very flexible hours for Uber to worry that they will no longer be able to work flexible hours?
Yeah, I think Uber has said that they would have to do some intense scheduling of like when, like tell when certain people can drive or whatever. I mean, it would basically look a lot more like shifts essentially and less like I can turn my phone on now and just work whenever and then turn it off and it's based on sort of a supply and demand
and
of the market.
And why would they need to do that? Because they would be legally obliged to do that? Or would they need to do that because somehow, like, if you make them employees, then you need to start scheduling them?
I don't know if it's a legal stipulation of you have to work this many hours per day or whatever. You know, I think it's more, I think it's, there are a few things. Like, they can't just have all of these people working at once and you have to sort of stagger the amount of time each one works. And
because I think that's the problem, right, is that what you want to avoid when you have employees is them all working at the times they all want to work. And
they do all
working.
Work at the same time because those are how the cycles of people going places work, right?
And we're already seeing a little bit of this in New York because I know they changed the law and there's like a minimum guarantee if you are working. And so as a result, I know I think like Lyft, they've said that, okay, that means you actually can't drive in certain areas because you wouldn't be able to make enough. So then they don't want to guarantee you that minimum. So if you're a driver, you can't drive at that time in that area. And I think that this will inevitably be this kind of push and pull between flexibility and support. And I think it's going to be finding that equilibrium, not necessarily saying it has to be 100% one or the other.
But Anna, I mean, so I guess the question which I have for you or Mike, I don't know, is this just going to be like another little complicating factor? What's that wonderful term that Jeff Bezos uses?
I don't know.
Something like that.
Complexifier?
Like, complexifier, yeah.
That's awful.
Is it going to be like a complexifier for the Uber algorithm, or is this actually like an existential risk to the entire business model?
I mean, you know better than I do, but probably the latter, right?
I think it's existential in the sense that like, so this is how I think they're looking at it right now. Right now, this is only California. I think they're worried that other states are going to take the lead and do the same thing. I was in Seattle last week and talking to some driver who was saying that they're already meeting to try to get ahead of an idea of this bill and come to some sort of compromise, I guess. But yeah, the whole company is based on the idea of paying people less and not giving them the benefits of an employee. And so I think if you do that, extrapolate that out to every city that they operate in across the world, it's a death blow, you know?
Maybe so shouldn't have gotten so big. I mean, the company was premised on using a workforce that it can't really pay.
Yeah.
But also the company has never made money. I mean, even with this like underpaid freelance workforce, it's still never made money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's kind of amazing. I mean, can you explain that one to me? Because they take, what is it, like north of 30% now of every fare?
Yeah.
Their overhead is just like a bunch of computers.
Yeah.
How do you contrive to lose money?
Is it the balloons?
That was the best. The birthday balloons inside.
They cut the spending on balloons.
No, that was such a good anecdote.
Yeah.
So it's subsidies. I mean, like, just remember back when they started here or whatever, like, every ride was artificially deflated for the amount that you're going to pay. And then, like, drivers were paid more to get them incentivized to use the platform. So the original reasoning was, well, once we get to equilibrium in our cities, we're going to stop doing these subsidies and things will be good. The problem is they just moved into food delivery as like their major area of growth. And they're like setting money on fire trying to subsidize that sort of growth. And food delivery, I would say, is where we were with ride hailing 3 to 5 years ago, where it's like you have SoftBank backing all of these players in food delivery, not only in the US, but like around the world. And they're all spending crazy amounts of money to give food away for free. Right. So people will use the service and like habituate them. But like, I don't see that abating anytime soon. It's only going to get worse.
So in terms of the like the core ride hailing product in mature cities like London or New York, is that actually profitable?
Yeah, so they are, and this is what they'll, you know, stress. That they can be they can break even if they turned off all the things that were burning the cash. which is like, okay. But also there are cities in which they are
profitable.
But
would the stock market mind, like if they turned off Uber Eats or whatever?
This is the growth versus profitability thing. Like I think this is like just a classic, like what do investors value more, right? And I think their ride-hailing business is starting to level off in terms of growth because they've saturated the world, right? And there are like a lot of other competitors. So where are they going to find that growth? They're going into food delivery for the next area of growth. That growth is costing them the same amount that it cost them initially with ride hailing. So it's totally a, I think if they turned it all off, then the investors would be like, where's your growth? You're doomed.
If I was Uber, I would not do the food delivery. I would merge with Lyft because then they would have so much more
illegal,
of
a right?
That's what I would do. That would be my plan.
Okay, Rockefeller over there.
No, but I do think that's like the, that's actually what, on a weird level, they've been trying to do, like not merge with Lyft because that really would be illegal, but drive them out of business so they no longer have that competition.
Yeah.
That was almost what happened until 2017. Like Lyft was literally at death's door and then Travis had his reckoning and Delete Uber happened and then they came, they had a second wind and now they're a public company. It's actually, they were so close to an alternate history of having no Lyft. Tragic.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Let's talk about the new Uber and the new Travis, who's the new man, literally. That I checked this with a former employee of WeWork. It is pronounced new man. It's not pronounced Neumann or anything like that.
Not new man. Newman.
Or Newman.
Okay.
But anyway, so
but
we
new
have...
new man makes the better, like, Ayn Rand character.
he is the new man. He bestrides the world on his Gulfstream G650.
Say who you're talking about.
We're talking about Mr. Newman.
Adam Newman.
Adam Newman.
The founder of WeWork.
The man who says that he wants to, A, be the world's first trillionaire, B, be president of the United States, even though he was born in Israel.
President of the world.
And C, wants to be president of the world, which is a job title that doesn't even exist. But he's like, yeah, president of the world. That sounds cool.
That sounds amazing.
That sounds good.
A little WeWork kind of White House kind of a thing.
We dictatorship.
We desperate. Yeah. That's perfect.
And also weed smoker. Because
nice.
On his Gulfstream, he would smoke a lot of weed, according to the Wall Street Journal, and then leave the weed on the Gulfstream for the owner of the plane to suffer major criminal liability.
Let's just consider it.
Everyone should go read this Wall Street Journal piece by Elliot Brown.
He knocked it out of the park.
Yes. It opens with the smoking on the plane, and I think it ends with a smoking somewhere else. I don't know. There's a lot of marijuana.
There's a lot of marijuana. And I remember talking to my Axios colleague, Dan Primack, about that piece. And he was like, well, I'm not sure there's that much new information in this story. And I was like, it kind of doesn't matter. If you're talking about something like an IPO, the only thing that matters is what do investors think that other investors are going to think about WeWork? And when you get a story like this, like, who wants to buy those shares?
No, he comes across as an idiot, I think. I mean,
ridiculous grin that he always wears. Yeah.
No, I agree. Sorry. Ugh. But completely agree.
And also, we should say WeWork delayed its IPO this week.
That is
the news.
But I think what was interesting from the article, and this goes back a little bit to in your book as well, this idea of people being drawn to him, though, that like he was the main selling point of this company to try to convince people that this was not just a real estate company with maturity mismatches, but that it was in fact this tech platform that was going to change the world.
They're going to elevate the world's consciousness.
I mean, that, I guess, flies. Yeah, that flies in the private markets when you put them in front of them and are like, blah, blah, blah. And then when you actually have to show your financials.
But Mike, I mean, you know a bunch of Silicon Valley venture capitalists. If you went up to a Silicon Valley venture capitalist and said, you know what I want to do is I want to get $1 billion from you so that I can elevate the world's consciousness. I mean, how far would you get?
I don't know, man. Like, I've never met Adam Neumann. I met Travis, but I've never met Adam. And like, I feel like the reality distortion field really goes far with some. And maybe we give some of these investors more credit than they're due. I think some are very smart, and then I think some of the money they raise is also very dumb, right?
And which side of the ledger is Masasan on?
I would read a whole book on Masasan. I want to know what the hell's that guy. He's either a genius or
not
totally insane, maybe part of both, but I would read, I don't know. I honestly don't know.
What was interesting about Adam Neumann is one of the things you write about in the book is the shares and the difference in the shares that Travis holds versus everybody else and how it made it almost impossible to oust him.
Yep.
And so I thought, well, everyone must have read Mike's book and followed this news and knew not to do that again.
Nope.
But they've done it again with Adam Neumann. He also has...
This is my favorite thing about the whole WeWork story. When there was a pushback on governance from potential investors, WeWork said, oh, you know what? We're not going to give Adam Neumann super voting shares of 20 votes per share. We're going to give him super voting shares of only 10 votes per share. That's fine.
They've learned, it just seems like investors really learn nothing from Travis from that whole experience.
I mean,
but I really do. I think you're right, though. I mean, I think some of this is just people have capital that they need to deploy and they're willing to believe these people. And I think you're also right that, like, these, like, the Travis and the Adam Neumann, they seem like, you know, these kind of crazy figures. But then when you read about Silicon Valley figures of the past, when you read about industrialists of the past, when you read about certain politicians, like, this actually is not an uncommon personality type.
Well, the personality type, I think the personality type, and I wrote about this in Axios Edge this week, that business and capitalism reward sociopaths. And
ooh, I like that.
And you see this in a bunch of different areas, and especially very charming sociopaths who can persuade people to give them attention and money and, you know, all the rest of it. And this is true of most investment bankers, but it's also true of Travis and Adam Neumann. And it's also true of Jeffrey Epstein. You know, like, you see this in a bunch of different areas. And
I mean, it's true of politicians, too. Like, I'm about halfway through the Robert Caro, Lyndon Johnson books.
Oh, God.
And, like, Lyndon Johnson is a monster.
But the big difference, I think, now is that between, you know, today's sociopaths, the new man, and the sociopaths of old, is that the sociopaths of old felt this need to make money. And today's sociopaths can, like, become incredibly wealthy by losing money. Right?
Well,
like, when was that ever possible?
They're still making money. Adam Neumann is still scamming WeWork out of money. He's sold shares, something Travis Kalanick didn't
do. He owns hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate.
He trademarked the word "we" and sold it to the company, which just needs to be repeated many times because it's just so devilish.
I do think, though, to your point about deploying capital, like, I think SoftBank's Vision Fund just changed everything. And, like, if you have $100 billion and you need to park it places
quickly,
very fast, before you raise your next fund, right, you need to go to the companies that require the most capital. And that's why they had to get into Uber. That's why WeWork, even though WeWork is stupid or it doesn't make actual sense to me, like, they still want to ingest billion-dollar slugs of money at a time. And so I'm wondering what the next, like, where those other things are going.
I agree. No, I mean, you have, it's a matter of, like, you know, again, you have incredibly low rates. You have a lot of people going into riskier and riskier things. You have, like, such a glut of savings that need to find homes.
Yeah.
It's not surprising that this is what we're seeing.
But what we're seeing now is, I think, this part, this era of the economy sort of screeching to a halt.
Mm.
Vision Fund 2 was meant to come along with another $100 billion because, like, what can you do with $100 billion? You really need, like, at least $200 billion. Vision Fund 2 was meant to come along, and it really looks as though the WeWork IPO has single-handedly made that much, much less likely.
Yeah.
Because people are like, wait, you're really not that smart after all. You bought into WeWork at a $47 billion valuation, and now they're talking about IPOing at like 10?
Ugh, God.
There's two other things I wanted to mention. First is Adam Newman's Businesses Before WeWork. I don't know if we've talked about
that. Oh, the crawlies, whatever they were.
What did he do? No, I have no idea.
He did the crawlies, which is like knee pads for babies. Because what is the slogan? It's like, because they hurt. But
even though they can't tell you, they are in pain or something like that.
Oh, my God. That's my therapy
and I'm like,
slogan.
No, they can tell you. They start crying. Like, okay.
And then the other one was collapsible high heels
yes.
for women.
No.
What? That is the worst. I mean, you're walking down the street and your collapsible heel collapses by
accident. I mean, I guess it's the idea
invention.
That, like, yeah, I mean, like, there's a part of me that was thinking through that. And I was like, well, maybe. But I'm like, you could make that work. But no. No, it just didn't. No,
it's just like his businesses are all like stoned fever dreams. Like, I bet babies really are when they're crumpled. I couldn't believe it.
My friend Lindsay Robertson used to have this occasional series on Twitter called Hideas.
Where, like, you would just,
or, you know, you would just kind of get stoned and like come up with an awesome idea, which makes perfect sense
yes,
when you're stoned.
Adam Newman has many good Hideas.
You should host that.
And the last thing I wanted to mention, because we talked about the meat policy before, which is WeWork
said
it would no longer pay for meat consumption for its employees. And Adam Newman in the Wall Street Journal, they concede he still is eating meat.
Not
it's still going on.
But better yet,
he's buying private jets.
So this is my favorite thing about the meat eating thing, and this came out in the journal story, was that, again, it was one of those ideas, basically. He just woke up one morning and said, we're banning meat. And then the whole corporate communications like edifice had to swing in to come up ex post with some rationale for it. And they're like, it's because we believe in sustainability or something.
Right,
but it wasn't. It was just because Adam came up with it one morning and when he was stoned.
It was literally right after the Starbucks. So I was like, this is total ego shot. It was after... Was Schultz doing the Starbucks straw thing, or whoever succeeded him came up with the no plastic straws at Starbucks? Like literally the next day, Newman did that. I was like, he just wanted to like, it was, you know, I don't know how much I can cuss on here, but he just wanted to like dick measure that much more than the last guy. Basically, that was my.
It was like woke dick measure.
Yeah, exactly.
My dick is so much woker than yours. You can't say that. You can't talk about woke dicks on the Slate. Slate Money, you can talk about woke dicks.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney.
This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Meanwhile, back in the real world, a whole bunch of General Motors employees are going on strike.
Indeed.
Which is a little bit unexpected.
Yeah, it is a bit unexpected. It's been quite a while. And I think there was also a thought that the negotiations were, you know, getting to a point that this wasn't necessarily going to lead to a strike. And then it did. And it's, you know, we're multiple days into this strike there. At this stage, you know, we aren't seeing, at least as far as I know of this morning, we aren't seeing a tremendous amount of positive signs, shall we say. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, because you basically have a lot of GM workers who, I mean, the workers, the actual union members kind of saying they're concerned about a lot of temporary workers being brought in. There are a number of other things, but that's one of the main issues. And then on the GM side, I mean, the initial deal they came out with in a lot of ways wasn't a horrible deal if you kind of look at all the details in it, but it didn't really address this main concern. And then the other issue you have are the heads of the union who are involved in this corruption scandal, an embezzlement scandal, which is part of the reason that they think GM actually made their deal public, because they didn't trust the union leadership. So it's a bit of a mess.
But the bigger picture here, I think, is just that, again, like, are we reaching a turning point between AB5 in California, the strikes in GM? We had the teacher strikes, which worked last year across the country. There's this other story going on right now, right here in New York, where Kickstarter, this, like, you know, very crunchy granola tech company, is trying to unionize, and the management is being a bit crap about that. And the, you know, have we finally reached the point at like 3.5% unemployment where like workers are managing to get a little bit of
power? I mean, I think we saw, I think it was in the summer that some data came out that said we've had more strike activity last year than we have had in a decade at least or more. So, and it's true that the economy is doing great and wages and salaries haven't really moved. So I think that you are seeing more labor agitation, and especially at GM, where one of the lines from the workers that we're seeing is like, we sacrificed for you during the Great Recession, like we made concessions, and now GM, you're doing great, you're doing fine now. So like,
right, but the problem
pay us back.
Line.
Yeah, and this is where it gets complicated, though, because the reality is like they're not doing fantastically well. And if you kind of look at long, like the kind of where trends are going, their GM is not particularly well placed. Although part of the reason they're not well placed, I would argue, is because of management. A lot of the kind of strategy, they waited way too long to restructure. They have way too many plants that are underutilized. Mm-hmm. So I think it's perfectly reasonable for people to criticize management and to say, why is Mary Barra being paid so much money considering what is actually going on? However, it doesn't change the fact that, you know, the auto industry is changing, and this isn't just GM, it's all of the big players. Like, they are going to have to be a bit more nimble. And how do we balance that with the need of workers for some security? It's not a simple solution.
No, it's not. And Business Week just ran a cover story with Mary Barra, and they profiled her. And it's really interesting because she's trying to catch up and pivot the company to become like an, God forbid, like an Uber, or like a Tesla. Like, she wants to go to electric really fast. She wants to go to self-driving. Mm. She sees the writing on the wall. So, but it's like, yeah, can you actually make that transition? It seems to me a huge open question. And I think there's some quote in the piece that's like, GM doesn't want to be Kodak, you know?
One of the interesting things about the Kickstarter story is that, and I had no idea, there are zero unionized tech companies.
Yes, they would be the first.
And it's like, what?
Yeah.
And so this is, and so part of this whole, like, when Mary Barra looks to Tesla or Uber,
what
she sees is an ununionized workforce. And she's like, that looks good. Can I have that? And if you look at what happens, I mean, there's been multiple stories about how miserable the life is for Tesla workers and how hard they need to work, and, you know, and how easy they get fired just because, you know, they looked at Elon Musk the wrong way one day and that kind of thing.
That's not even fake. That's true.
which, by the way, also happened at WeWork, except for they looked at Adam Newman's wife the wrong way.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
She didn't like their energy.
She didn't like that energy.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
But so, Mike, like, how and why is it that none of these companies have managed to unionize? And do you think that we are going to see this happening soon?
No, I think that's you're totally getting a point that has been a weird grand irony to me, is that workers are starting to figure out that they have power. You know, like, I think in the Valley, or in tech specifically, I think companies are really screwed when their employees start pushing back. And like that, and that's when leaks starts happening. That's when people start doing walkouts. Google has gone through some like deep shit for the past few years now because all this gnarly stuff is coming out about the executives. And so it's, you know, I don't want to be patronizing, but it's funny to me that they're starting to discover the idea of unionizing or like just the idea of like that they have a voice. And I think it's a positive thing, but it's just they're starting to really recognize that coming together and pushing for that for change is something they can do.
Agreed.
Except in Google's point of view, they come together and push for change by like doing a one-day walkout.
Right.
It's like, wouldn't it be more effective to actually unionize?
Not necessarily, though. And I think that this is actually like, I think when you're talking about kind of old school unionization, I think that can make a tremendous amount of, and it did obviously historically make a tremendous amount of sense, especially when you had industrial kind of jobs.
Sure.
When you're starting to get into kind of like higher level jobs at places like Google, you are going to have a lot of employees who are not necessarily going to want to go on the kind of unionized pay scales and that kind of thing that comes with unionization. It is a little bit more complicated. And so
I see, I'm not 100% sure that, I think this is something I hear a lot from management at companies which unionize, is that, well, if you unionize and everything becomes like, let's say you look at these union contracts, and God knows I used to work at a company which had, you know, a union contract which was 500 pages thick and was just, there was no flexibility and no nimble anything, and it was horrible. But clearly, as you say, like the workers at companies like Google don't want that kind of union contract. And if the workers don't want it, then, and if the management doesn't want it, then that's not the contract you're going to wind up with.
And I agree with that. I mean, I do think that there can be a form of collective action that in a form of, you know, unionization or whatever, that isn't the same as it was at GM, right? Like that these are different models. And I do think that when you're at kind of a new economy company, like you are probably going to need different standards, and people are going to probably want that. But I think that we are probably getting to a point now where people are like rethinking how workers can gain power. And I think that that's good. I just think that sometimes there's a desire to always do like, well, let's do what worked 65 years ago. And it's like, well, no, let's maybe think about what actually could work now.
So what could work now?
I don't know what could work now. I'm sorry. I was going to say something totally different. I was going to say what I like about Kickstarter trying to unionize is that it exposes the hypocrisy of tech companies and their supposed ethics and ideals, because Kickstarter is a public benefit corporation.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it has lofty ideals about who it is and how it works in the world. But at the end of the day, now that their workers are trying to unionize, Kickstarter said, like, we don't support
so
that.
I actually did some reporting on this.
Ooh.
Which is something I very rarely do. I try to.
You're on a roll.
I'm on a roll. I actually sent an email to B-Lab, which is the company which like certifies all of the benefit corporations. And they said, oh, yeah, like this could be a real problem for your B Corp status. And if you are being evil to unionization attempt, then that can threaten your B Corp status. And if you just go back a couple of years ago to 2017, the other grand crunchy granola company, which is very proud of being a B Corp, Etsy, gave up its B Corp status because it wanted to be evil instead. And it turns out that, you know, when push comes to shove, like it turns out that this B Corp status is like it's this lovely little badge you can hold on to for as long as it feels good. Yeah. And then the minute it doesn't feel good, you can throw it away.
Well, we don't need to get into the entire argument about B Corps. You can go back in the podcast libraries to see me go on my rants about B Corps, but I do think that this is also the reality as companies become a little bit more mature, and also as if, you know, we're getting to a place where capital isn't quite as easy to get as it was in the past. And maybe there's actually going to be a push for companies to make a tad bit more money. Or if you're in an industry like where you're shifting that, yeah, you do have to make difficult choices. And I think it's great that you know, we are getting to a point where workers are pushing back. But I also think that doesn't mean that there aren't concerns that management would also have on the other side of that. It doesn't mean you're evil. I mean, it just means like you also want to run a profitable company.
Mm.
Like it's
sure.
Maybe. I feel it. No,
they don't want to run a profitable company. We just spent the previous segment discussing how none of these companies are profitable.
And that was the thing, right?
That's my point, is that like, shifting, like you're starting to get more the ability to just continue to not be profitable in the newer economy, I think, is going to be challenged more and more, and people see that. And I think in the old economy, that's not the case. You, in fact, do actually have to be profitable.
You need to be profitable, but you don't need – I think this is the thing that a lot of people running B Corps, especially the established ones like Patagonia, which have been around for decades – you'd need profits to be sustainable, but you don't need to grow your profits every year.
If you're a publicly traded company, then yes, you do.
You actually don't.
Yes, you do if you're a growth company, and that's the but only reason anybody's growth, investing saying, you.
No, but
because then no one's going to invest in you, and your market cap is going to go, and your ability to get capital is going to be much, much lower.
Okay, we've had this this conversation on the show before, but you don't need to have a growing share price just because you are a public company. Anyway,
if you're a utility,
I think we're just going to wait this one out and move on to a numbers round.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer, and I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Mike, did you bring a number this week?
I did.
Awesome. What's your number?
It's 2020. Do I explain it?
Please do.
Is that the year of the next presidential election?
God, I'm not that dumb.
Is that your vision? You're not wearing glasses.
No, that is not.
The glasses
my
are on the table. Yeah. Sorry, listeners.
2020 is the year that Airbnb announced it intends to go public.
Correct.
And I have no idea why they did that or why they announced it, but it was very weird.
Yeah, it was
weird.
They
have to offer equity to the hosts. And to if the, you want to offer equity to the hosts, apparently, this is what I read in your paper, I think,
well,
today.
I don't tell my colleagues. I don't read your work.
I think it was your. Maybe it wasn't.
No, it probably
was. Who can say? But that's why. Then they had to be public. That's what's
up. So they're getting ahead of oh, because they want to just offer SEC, they have to. Okay, got it.
How's that going to go?
I don't know. They waited too long, Brian. Yeah. Actually, a lot of the employees are very mad that they waited this long. And like now the markets are not conducive to
What's been interesting to me about Airbnb is that they are one of the rare private companies who's managed to do some pretty significant M&A while still remaining private. Mm. One of the reasons to go public has always been, well, then you get this acquisition currency and you can go around and do things like buy Hotel Tonight, or they just bought, or they just took a huge stake in Atlas Obscura. And
really?
Yeah.
I didn't see that. Crazy.
David Plotz.
Yeah, which is run by the former editor of Slate.
And the current host of Political Gabfest.
So, yeah, so, but they, it's interesting to me how long they've been able to do those kind of deals without going public.
I mean, I think that's the, it's again, another indication of this kind of bizarre private market we've had because of rates and, again, all of the capital needing a home.
My number is 80 million euros, which is my favorite story of the week, which is these guys did a scan. They did the best crime ever, where they basically, you know, those like weird rubber face masks they have in the Mission Impossible stories change your face. They made a rubber face mask of the French defense minister. And then they would like Skype all of these like art dealers and other rich people in France. And they'd be like, we want you for a secret mission.
Oh my.
You've got to like send me like 20 million euros and then I will bail out these hostages. And then the French state will pay you back and you'll get an, you know, a knighthood or something. And then all these people fell for it. They managed to raise 80 million euros.
Oh, my God. Wow. That's amazing.
And we were talking about this earlier, actually, with Jordan Weissman, and he was bringing up the idea that, like, in order to make this scam work, you have to target people who are wealthy enough to think that the finance minister would actually contact them. It's very well thought through.
Defense minister.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Because the finance minister has access to. Yeah, it's such a glorious crime. It really is. Someone has to make this into a movie.
Agreed. Mine
is like a bummer, and I don't want us to end on a bummer.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So mine is 2.9 billion.
Birds.
It's the birds.
I'm glad I didn't pick that.
2.9 billion fewer birds now than there was 50 years ago, according to a new study published in Science. That's just damn sad. And it's because the climate is changing and the the birds are dying. And it's not just like
is it because
fancy,
of cats?
It's not cats. It's not
because Jonathan Franzen says it's cats. According to Jonathan Franzen, you just put the bells on the cats and it solves the problem.
Well, and that was the saddest part of the piece was like, what can I do, like Emily Peck, to help the birds live? Is just like, there's things you can do to your windows in your house so they don't fly into the windows. Mm. That is not the problem. It's like pesticide, global warming, blah, blah, blah. And it's not fancy birds that are dying. It's not like exotic birds. It's just like your everyday.
It's not the sexy duck. In Central Park.
The hot duck is going to be okay.
I looked for the hot duck the other day. I couldn't find it.
I think the hot duck is gone. I'm sorry.
I hope it's not.
Oh, see, we made it light.
Yeah.
There you go.
See, my number now isn't just not that good. So mine is 500 million. So this actually goes back to WeWork. So Adam Neumann has a credit line. It's actually a personal credit line. Ugh. And he uses his WeWork private shares as collateral. So now his collateral has markedly declined in value. So his ability to take on additional, so you're actually probably going to have the banks coming in saying he's going to have to pay back money or he's going to have to post liquidity because his collateral has declined so much. So I thought that was an interesting part of the story.
Doesn't your heart just bleed? Poor Adam Neumann in his private jet, who really cares about global sustainability while flying in his private jet.
Yes.
I have decided this is going to be one of a repeated feature in my newsletter. It's going to be like ban private jets, because this was not my idea, I hasten to add. I got this idea from Izzy Kaminska at FT Alphaville, and she's like, this would be great. It would totally cut down on like the Kardashian industrial complex. But I'm like, that's like, there are so many other advantages to banning private jets, including I'm kind of convinced that if you ban private jets, then the Epstein scam could never have happened. He used his private jet so much to get into people's like good graces.
Also, Succession wouldn't be as good without private jets.
Succession, like a lot of very important scenes in Succession do take place
but
on private jets.
If someone offered you a ride on their private jet, would you say no because of principle, or would you just take the ride? Be honest.
I definitely remember when I started out as a financial journalist, you know, in the 20th century, many, many years ago, there was this thing, and it still goes on, but like it was when I was very young, and I was like, oh, this is what happens, is you're profiling a CEO and then they bring you onto the private jet and it's all very glamorous and you're very impressed. And I was like, and in the back of my head, I was like, yeah, I kind of want one of those profiles. So I get to like jet around in the private jet. Yeah. Or when you're interviewing the oligarch and he's like, I'm sorry, I'm in my Dasher for all of August, so I'm just going to have to send my private jet to pick you up, which like does happen. And now I think, you know, now that I'm old and grumpy, maybe I would be less prone to sort of jump at that.
Also, I had a friend who...
Good for you.
Yeah. I know. I, in fact, do have... No, I have a friend. It's not me. In fact, it is a friend who... the company she works for, her boss does have a private jet. And she said she hates when she has to fly, particularly because she's like, then you have to sit and talk to your boss for the entire time that you're on the plane. She's like, I would just much rather take the commercial flight and not have to interact with my boss for this entire flight.
We're going to get it on Twitter for this whole conversation about our bubble.
It's
true.
One of the problems with my job is I have to fly in the private jet with my boss. It's so awkward.
Fair.
I mean, that's like 0.1% world problem.
Yes, that's very true.
I think that's it. Thank you for listening to the amazing Mike Isaac episode of Slate Money this week. Email address, as ever, is slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Jessamine and Molly for producing, and we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.